Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. You know, it's not easy to write a book, and there are special challenges when the subject is autobiographical and the life that's revealed includes experiences that are painful and uncomfortable. The stories of self that poet and author Mary Carr reveals in her books are powerful and challenging. Her memoir, The Liar's Club, was a New York Times bestseller for over a year and was named one of the year's best books. Her third book, published in 2009, is Lit, a memoir which, she says, details my journey from black belt sinner and lifelong agnostic to unlikely Catholic. And I am very pleased to welcome Mary Carr to State of Belief Radio today. Mary, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Welton. Always good to see a man from Louisiana.
I should tell these people that this is the first time we've met and that we're friends.
We're old friends. We go way back now.
Yeah, that's right. And you know what? You offer so many different opportunities for discussion. We could deal with a dysfunctional family background. We could deal with moving away from drugs, teaching as a respected professor in a university, a devotee of Roman Catholic spirituality, and interest in a maturing spirituality, writing best-selling books. Mary, talk about integration. How do you keep all that together?
Well, I only get paid by one person at a time, so whoever, and I'm a little bit of a hooker here, Welton. I mean that in the best way. Whoever's paying me gets me. So I'm only doing this for free because I like you. When I'm working on a book of memoir, that's all I do. When I'm teaching, I don't write because I find I resent my students if I do. I can work on poems like when I'm traveling or something when I'm writing, because I travel back and forth between Syracuse and New York. But basically, I have a very good ability to concentrate, and I just shut out every other thing when I'm doing whatever it is I'm doing. And I usually am fortunate enough as a professor to have periods of time. What was hard was when my kid was little and I was teaching and writing and raising a baby and painting the house, you know, doing everything a single mom does.
Yeah. So. Well, people who have read your books and poetry know that you changed in a dramatic way. Why, when, and how did that change occur?
Those are hard questions. I changed because it was change or die. It was adapt or die. It was a Darwinian deal. I had a little baby. I was in the middle of drinking myself to death. My daddy drank himself to death. My mother, we wished, would have died and didn't. Shot up the house instead. We had bullet holes all over the house. Thanks. She shot at whoever she dated. And she didn't date. She married. She married seven times. So that's the dysfunctional family part. And, I found myself in my early 30s. In some ways, I looked as if I were together. I was married to a big Harvard hockey player, looked like something you win at a raffle. I had a baby boy, and I was teaching at Tufts and Harvard and in the academic ghetto. But I wanted to blow my brains out every day. I was very depressed. I realized when I finally got sober, I'd been depressed my whole life. And the only way I could get sober, I tried everything and some self-help groups which I usually don't talk about very much. But I noticed that the people who didn't drink, who didn't want to blow their brains out and weren't mad, all had a spiritual practice. Maybe they were Buddhist, or maybe they just meditated every day, or they did a lot of charity work, but they had some active spiritual practice that involved not themselves alone, but other people. Mm-hmm. And so it was suggested to me that I get on my knees and pray. And I had never prayed in my life. So I didn't know you couldn't cuss and swear. I didn't know you weren't supposed to do the double eagle fingers up in the air at God and holler. And in a way, it was a very honest conversation that I had with God from the very beginning. And something started to happen when I prayed. And the only way – I can only describe it physically. The great thing about Catholicism, I became Catholic eventually, was it's carnal. It's all about the body. And God came to me where I was. I was in a state of real despair, and I would get these moments of quiet that I now think of as sacred moments. And it was the only quiet I'd ever had in my life. Hmm. And I didn't call it God.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was curing myself of alcoholism with biofeedback. Like, that's what I would have told you. Yeah. I wouldn't have had a sacred or religious spin on it. But I just kept going back to that well. It's kind of like the story of the woman in the well in the Bible. You know, it's where the water was. And I kept going back there because I was having a hard time raising a kid.
Mm. When did you discover that you're a good writer?
Well, I still haven't quite discovered that. I think I guess I always wanted to write, and I always wrote a little bit better than the people my age. So I still wouldn't call myself, I think of a good writer as, you know, Don DeLillo or Harper Lee or, you know, I don't know, Ralph Ellis. You know, I still don't think myself as a good writer, but I'm better than I would be if I didn't write more than once, I guess.
So you don't mind, though, if some of us think you are a good writer?
I hope you all do. I hope you all spend a lot of money buying my books, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them all, but you just at least buy them.
Yeah. Why do you write? I mean, now I know what you said. You have the hooker mentality and all that, but you don't write just to make money, do you?
No, I mean, I started reading, I think, because I was lonely and my house was lonely. And it was a place I could go. And especially when I read poetry, you know, I was a depressed child, very depressed. I had a suicide attempt as a child. And with a bunch of aspirin, nothing serious, relatively speaking. No one even knew, you know, what had happened. But when I read poetry, if you're very depressed, you have a hard time concentrating and you can't read longer things. And to hear how somebody felt I could connect with another person emotionally when I read a poem. And to some extent, that connection with language and with the imagined other is what permitted me to enter into prayer, I think, in some ways. It was a natural thing for me to do, to be speaking to somebody or feel like I was in communion with somebody I couldn't see.
Hmm. You have a great following for your blog, and you're always as unconventional there as you are surprising everywhere else. Who is the audience, and what's the message on that blog?
Well, it's interesting. It's not a very literary audience, even though the repartee is very literary. It's a lot of people from very different beliefs. Some people are atheist. Some people do yoga. You know, there are some very fundamentalist Christians. I have a couple of friends I know are Pentecostal from where I grew up.
What do they do when you just let it rip like you do?
Well, you know, supposedly it's really just, but it's also people who are Catholic. I have priests and nuns and I mean, the message of my church and of yours too is a message, and of Jesus in general, but also of Muhammad and of every other faith, is that we're supposed to love and tolerate each other's differences. And so when I feel myself getting my back up, even if somebody is homophobic, say, which, as you know, my friend Shelley's, I was a groomsman in my friend Shelley Wright's wedding recently.
Right.
So, and I understand there are a lot of people, and, you know, somebody said to me at one point, you know, what do you think about your support of, you know, gay rights is when these people are sinners and they're going to burn in hell? And I said, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. But obviously I don't see it that way, but I would like us to be able to continue talking to each other.
Hmm.
Despite our differences. And I think what's wrong with the political conversation and with the religious conversation right now, and why we're having a lot of wars and stuff, is people aren't willing to tolerate each other's differences. So I see it as my decision on that blog to try to welcome everybody's beliefs, no matter what they are, even if they disagree with me.
You want to tell people what the blog
address is? Well, it's just on, I don't even know what it is. It's on Facebook. I think it's Mary Carr Litt. Or Mary Carr Lit Up, Mary Carr Lit, I think, on Facebook. They're about five. It's the one that has about 5,000 or so followers.
Yeah. This is a strange question, but is guilt a part of your life?
Oh, well, shame is.
Shame is.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about being Catholic.
Well, that's why I'm asking you that.
Yeah. It is. And we're good at guilt. Y'all are good at, being good natured. Much more than we are.
Don't generalize.
No, I mean, y'all can grin and get on with it. And we are some maudlin bastards, you know. Y'all have better, your music's more fun. You know, you have better fellowship, you Protestants. By you, I mean you Protestants.
Well, why are you a Catholic?
They spoke to me. The body on the cross, I'll be honest with you. I have a friend who's a Passionist priest, which is a group of priests that in some ways, they're very active in the community and with the poor. But I understood suffering, I think, based on how I grew up.
Of course.
And a lot of people, my mother, I remember her saying when I became Catholic, you go up, there's that gory, bloody, butchered body on the cross. I mean, I worship the resurrected Christ. And I was like, well, we all do, but where are we? Mm-hmm. And for me, I suffer a lot. I just do. I have a dark mentality. I'm not a good-natured individual. I'm socially adroit, but not particularly good-natured, not easygoing. I do want to kill everybody on the subway when it's hot and they have my seat. And so I understand suffering. And so for me, and also the bodiliness of it, to be honest with you, standing up and kneeling down and like breathing in and saying prayers together with people, which I know for your people often seems like cat-like or rote or, you know, like these kind of big brother monsters, not being individual and having an individual connection with the Lord, but just kind of going through the motions. But for me, as somebody who really secretly believes that I am the center of the universe, that's actually a good thing. For somebody like me in my spiritual practice, I walk into church. Here's the way I describe it. You know how when you go to the state fair and you see everybody and you're like, oh, my Lord, who are these people?
Yeah.
Eating the fried dough. And then you have a moment. I don't know if it's when you're eating cotton candy and you see somebody else. For me, it's either on the bumper cars or at the end of the night in the little fairs, they'll have fireworks. And everybody looks up and is going, ah, you know, and they're in a state of awe together. And you look at them and you say, you know, I am kin to these people. These people are like me. And I walk into church and I think, and I hate everybody, and I leave and I don't. So it's literally 100% has nothing to do with doctrine or ideology. It's entirely to do with practice. The practice of it for me makes me a better person.
So you can put up with a conservative theology even though you have a pretty liberal social ethic.
Well, the church is very different. As you know, despite the doctrine, I don't think of the Pope as the church, and I don't think of the ideology or doctrine. It's also, you know, I think of it as the people, and my church is also very good about working with the poor, very good at it. And we often, there is such a thing as liberation theology. And actually, I just saw a survey where Catholic parishes are more tolerant of gay people than most every other parish, including Jewish, Protestant, which was surprising to me, but that there are more gay and lesbian masses and AIDS hospices and stuff like that. So not in every church, obviously, but I guess certainly I'm in New York City. Dorothy Day had the Catholic Worker downtown. So, you know, all hierarchies are annoying to me. I'm an outlaw by nature. So to be an outlaw in the Catholic Church is kind of an easy. There are a lot of us.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you a feminist?
Sure.
And what does that mean?
Well, I think it's harder to be a girl than it is a boy. It's harder to be black than to be white. Harder to be a girl than to be a boy. You know, harder to be poor than it is to be rich. You know, harder to be short than to be tall. You know what I mean? Just all. So, and I, as a young girl, you know, for instance, I've always supported myself. I've never, no man I've ever been with has ever paid my bills. And so I believe in the equality of women. So, yeah, do I think women ought to be priests? Yes, absolutely.
Are you political?
Not so much. I mean, I think certainly, like, for instance, on my blog or in my writing, I'm not a very good politician. It bores me. I find it very tedious. So, but for instance, I have a very good priest friend who's a Dominican, who's a very conservative, in terms of doctrine guy, and yet is spiritually still very advanced and very tolerant. And we argue, but there's kind of no malice in it. So I'm not that political. I'm probably not as political as I ought to be.
I see. What do you read?
Oh, I read everything. You know, I'm reading right now a book on Revelations. It's about to come out by Elaine Pagels, the great Christian theologian, I think.
She's been working on that one a while.
She's been working on it 9 years. Yeah. And I just went to Princeton and spoke to her seminar, and she gave me a copy of The Galley. It's an amazing book.
Yeah.
It is. It's going to mess up your people.
Yeah.
The way the conservative movement has, I think, often the fundamentalist movement has kind of appropriated the book of Revelations. And she puts so much of it in historical context.
Yeah.
And she's so immersed in all the prophets, I think, and such a great biblical scholar.
Just so you'll know, you're hacking off some people by calling them my people. They don't think I am.
They don't think you're a Protestant.
That's right.
You're Baptist.
That doesn't make sense to them.
What are you then?
I'm a Baptist and I'm a Christian, and but you know, there are some people that disagree on that. Just like some people would say
disagree on me.
You can't be a good Catholic or a good Christian. What's your take on contemporary literature?
Right now?
Yeah.
I think it's in bad shape. I think it's not a great age of fiction. I think it's a great age of nonfiction. I think, for instance, the other thing I was reading last night, I've been going back and forth between, I'm very interested in Russian history and the Russian Revolution. I'm reading a book on the Romanovs. And also, I just finished a book on Leningrad and another biography of Stalin. So for some reason, I'm very interested in Russian history. I think there's a lot of hyper-intellectual, kind of pretentious, I say a lot of contemporary literature is a trick on white people. It's like my friends who are people of color, almost to a one, are kind of not drawn in. You know, again, this is probably a racist generalization. I don't mean it as such. But they're not drawn in by this kind of very pyrotechnic intellectual prose that is very self-referential, not very unified, and pretty hard to understand. And doesn't so much reward study for me. I'm a feeling girl. I'm an old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon. I have a lot of heart, and I like what I read to be moving, emotionally moving. So
what's your take on contemporary religion?
Well, see, since I didn't know what it was like before, it's kind of hard to know. It seems to me like we're all too dug in, you know, and again, one of the things that I've been interested in on my Facebook page is seeing people of all these different places when you post something and people kind of get their fur ruffled, and then you'll see them kind of all start to come around and come to consensus or come to agreement, come to accept ideas that oppose theirs. I mean, I remember before I was baptized, I went to see an old nun who was about 80 years old, and I was on something called the Peace and Social Justice Committee in this church, even before I was baptized, and with the Berrigans. At that time, Jerry Berrigan is a member of that parish. And this old nun was raising money for AIDS ministry in Africa, and someone said, well, don't you think these people are going to burn in hell because they haven't been baptized, and more or less. I mean, they said that. And she said, you know, when I was a young sister and I moved to Africa, I used to think that way. And now I think, you know, the Holy Spirit assumes many forms. And for me, that's the great thing about a tripartite God, is there is the Holy Spirit is a female pronoun, for one, in the Greek, right? And it does assume many forms. It's not so nailed down, and it is where God, I think, speaks to us all in our hearts.
Mary, this is a mess because I've got half as many more questions to ask you as I have, and we're out of time.
Oh, no.
But I've got one question I've got to ask you. This program is going to air for most people either on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve.
Oh, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Well, that's what I want to know. Share a Christmas message out of your experience
for our people. I've got a great one. My priest, the priest who baptized me, who, by the way, was a guy who listened to Rush Limbaugh, which I don't, but was a guy who was very spiritually evolved. And last year, a year ago, 2 years ago, right before he died, I brought him a little poinsettia. I was leaving Syracuse to go on my book tour, and I was afraid he was going to die while I was gone. And so I didn't want to go. I was going to see him every day. I didn't want to say goodbye to him. I brought him a little poinsettia, and he was, at that time, he was in a wheelchair. He was covered in sores and scabs, and he had this cancer on his head that looked like kind of suppurating tree bark, bloody, pussy. And I handed him that poinsettia, and he said, "Let's go give it to the Blessed Mother." And I said, "Is there a chapel here?" He said, "Yeah." We go down in the basement of this nursing home on his little wheelchair, that's a little electric wheelchair. We get in the elevator, and I'm looking at him with that flower in his lap and that cancer on his head. And I thought, you know, it's like the little drummer boy. And we went down there, and the room was a hideous room that overlooked the Dipsy dumpsters in the back of the nursing home. And there's this ugly little icon, this kind of Neo-African icon of the Virgin Mary and the baby. And it was hideous. And he said, put it there. And he said, no, move it over there next to it. He said, "Looks good, doesn't it?" I said, "You know, Father Ken, it looks great." And he says, "Let's pray the Magnificat." Like you would say to somebody, "Let's go have a couple of beers and watch the game." And that desire that he never lost to give whatever he was given, however humble it was, to me, is the great story of Christmas, I think.
What a great one. Mary Carr. Mary, you don't hold back on what you share in your writing, and that's to the benefit of your readers. You haven't held back in this conversation, and I'm grateful for it. I've learned from you, as I always do, and I'm confident our listeners have also. I can't thank you enough for being with us on State of Belief Radio today.
Thank you, Welton. God bless.
God bless you.
Thank you.